This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lands, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues here every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, Science and Controversy on the Sustainable Lens on Radio here every Thursday night at 7 o'clock and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz. Welcome to the Sustainable Lens on Radio. My name's Anton. I'm joined by Sam Mann, and our interviewee today is David Clark, who is, can I call you the Shadow Revenue Minister? Is
that you can. Yeah. I won't be offended if you say that.
The of revenue in New Zealand?
No, that would be, in fact, not a bad title, Anton. Thank you.
And MP for Dunedin North. And we're going to be chatting about sustainability issues with David today. Sam, would you like to?
We haven't managed to speak on air since you got into Parliament, so congratulations.
Thank you very much, Sam. Yeah, it's been an interesting first year.
Interesting? Is that the word you're using?
Yeah, it certainly has been politically pretty interesting. And I think, of course, that's any role's interesting when it's new to you. But I think probably when people look back at New Zealand political history, they'll also be looking at this as something of a year where things changed. The government became a whole lot less popular. It started with the teapots, tapes stuff around the election time, but that really got some traction in the year that followed. And so the mood has changed around the acceptability of the government and the way it's going about things. And within the different political parties, they've each had their own little show going on. So it's been a year with a lot happening. I mean, I'm very pleased that I was able to put my holidays bill forward and see that progressing through the Parliament, all going well. That will become law and we'll have a couple of extra holidays every 7 years. And at the same time, we will have illustrated that margin in Parliament is pretty fragile because that will be legislation passed against the government's wishes. So, it's an interesting times. And before I get much further, I've got a bit of a head cold, so... The voice, I must apologise.
It's a radio voice.
A radio voice. People have said I sound a bit like John Rawls, so I haven't had swooning women chasing me down the street or anything like that as a consequence.
We'll get you to sing a ballad at the end. How about that?
I think it'd be best for all of us if that didn't happen.
So I want to know about the process of becoming an MP. So tell us what happened a year ago, the Sunday morning.
The Sunday morning, the day after. It's a funny thing because there was obviously a year of pretty solid campaigning before that and a lot of effort locally from supporters and activists who, without whom one doesn't get elected. And so that was a really big year. And then the morning after, it's all a bit surreal because, of course, the campaigning stops. What's become your life and as a new candidate, somebody with a full-time job and a campaign to run, suddenly finds that they've been elected, that there's a period where government's forming and there's actually not very much to do. There's a few media interviews, people wondering who this new guy is and what they're going to contribute, actually a certain amount of time on one's hands. Resigning from the existing job was one of the first things I had to do. And then start to plan around trips to Wellington and the official ceremonies that kick off after that. It's an interesting rite of passage, really. There's a lot of ceremony around it, and the way in which Parliament runs is unique, I think. It's not something that we experience in ordinary life as civilians. There is some really arcane ceremony, I think you could say, fairly, and all of it designed to ensure that when you are one of those people serving the public in the role of a member of parliament, that you're aware that you're carrying a particular responsibility and a privilege that you should never forget, and you are reminded of that constantly in the parliamentary environment. This ceremony harks back to the fact that you are one piece in a long historical machine playing a particular role and serving a particular constituency, and that you're part of something much bigger. And I think that is the really nice bit about the ceremony. It constantly reminds you that you're something that's a Johnny come lately who's in there with great ambitions to make a difference, but you're also part of something that's bigger than just you. And it's nice that symbolism sits there to remind all members of Parliament of their role of service and their role in that wider picture.
I remember Norman Kirk saying that he really appreciated a lot of parliamentary ritual, especially the morning prayer, because he could learn a standing order in each prayer. Which I thought was an interesting use for the time.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Yeah, there are a lot of MPs who think that the time for that has passed. I enjoy that particular ritual, and it's a call to highest ideals, and I think that's an important marker at the start of Parliament each day.
How do you, and this is an obvious question, but how do you square that with some of the what appears at this end, from the civilian end, as it were, is less than mature antics that occur, especially in question time and things like that, where it just seems to be point scoring and not particularly productive. How do these two things square off against each other?
Indeed, and first thing to say, of course, is it's an appeal to highest ideals. It doesn't mean that suddenly the members of Parliament become saints. They certainly do not, and anyone that would pretend that they did would be kidding themselves. Equally, it's true that question time in particular is a lot about theatre and advocacy. So you have people on each side of Parliament trying to represent best the people that they care about. So just as in the criminal justice system in a court situation, you have people arguing one side of the case vehemently and people arguing the other side of the case vehemently. And then the judge makes the decision, or the jury makes the decision. In our case, the voters make the decision about who's right and wrong and the ideals that are expressed, but also on the basis of who's advocating the best and most effectively for a particular set of values. And we, in the Labour Party, of course, value equality and opportunity and a sense of hope for the future. And we think that we want to see a fairer society. And so if we're able to articulate that or point out when ministers of the Crown are not meeting up to that standard of fairness or not providing opportunity, then it's incumbent upon us to point it out. In fact, that's our job as opposition spokespeople. So, you know, we've just recently, in the last couple of months, learnt that New Zealand's a more unequal society than it's ever been. And that means that as opposition people, we need to point out how that affects people. It means that there are lots of vulnerable children. We're told in the latest report on the issue, expert report, that there's 247,000 kids in New Zealand in poverty. And that's not acceptable. Mm. And so our job is to point that out, to really get stuck into the ministers who are trying to promote policies that actually lead to carrying on that outcome in perpetuity, and say that there is another way.
Your previous careers have been, and I'm making a little assumption here, have been about consensus and cooperation, and now you're in something that's entirely, as you're describing it, adversarial. How have you fitted into that? You've made quite a figure for yourself in that adversarial arena. People speak well of your performance there. How have you managed that?
I think that the juxtaposition is perhaps not as stark as you're painting it. I do think, my background as a Presbyterian minister, my view about what Christianity has to offer is that it's a countercultural movement. Without getting too theological, when Jesus said, there is only one God, in that particular biblical passage, what he was saying is, I won't bow down to the gods of the state. And what he was saying wasn't a claim that was particularly powerful or threatening to anybody, because he was a guy that was about to be bloody hung, drawn and quartered. He wasn't about to have a successful mission. It was a countercultural statement. He was saying the gods of the day, the materialism, the the Caesar's particular baubles of power are not things that he's going to worship and find as his highest ideal. You know, and it wasn't, it certainly wasn't a statement of self-aggrandizement. And so Christianity at its best challenges poverty. You know, that's one of the things Jesus banged on about right through the New Testament and the Bible. He didn't talk about sexuality or other things that often Christians want to make a big meal of. He talked about poverty and how, you know, the vulnerable should be looked out with for and got alongside. And so those kinds of issues to me are incredibly congruent with what I'm doing now. And it's also true. I mean, the people that founded the Labour Party saw it as applied Christianity. Most of the key figures in the early days were actually Christians themselves. And in a way, when we get back to challenging injustices, you know, back to the causes of social justice and making sure everyone gets a fair go, when we get back to those issues as a Labour Party, we are actually going back to our roots and saying that that these are the issues that form the party and these are the things that should take us forward. So I see a whole lot of congruity in there.
Mm-hmm.
Consensus decision making probably wouldn't be the way I would have described my Treasury experience, but but no, I think that healthy disagreement is good where it's not based on personalities. And that's, you know, I think that's the line that gets crossed sometimes and that Parliament finds hard to convey, you know, effectively. And, you know, I think the public don't like to stomach that. They don't like to see people getting stuck into each other. And that's always a challenge in Parliament because usually you are up against one other person who's putting stuff backwards and forwards. And I notice that my counterpart, quite often if he's on the losing side of an argument, he starts getting stuck into me, and the temptation to get stuck back into him is right there. And
playing the man rather, playing the ball rather than the man. Is that what we're talking
that's
about?
That's the aim. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we're all human, but we try to do our best on that one.
Is the sport and the theatre of the House a distraction, or does it add value?
I think it adds value, but that's not to say there aren't other ways of doing things, and I think we should be starting to explore what those other ways are. My personal view is that there must be a better way. You know, and likewise in the adversarial system in the justice sector, often family group conferences at their best can provide a better outcome than a court system, where you actually get people fronting up to their victims and finding ways of putting things right rather than, you know, through restorative justice type ideals rather than it being all about revenge. And the original idea of the prison system was about, you know, reflection and putting things right. We seem to have gotten away from that. Likewise, in the parliamentary environment, we've now got MMP, which is actually about parties getting alongside each other, making compromises, and finding out what's in the greatest interest of everybody. And yet we have a system that's still based on that one side against the other model. And so that sits in a funny tension. And I wonder whether things like the prime ministerial question time they have in the UK might be a better model, where it's one-on-one. You actually do get the chance to ask some in-depth questions, and there's not crowds cheering around you. You know, whether there isn't merit in exploring something like that. The whole idea of question time is to put the minister on their toes and see if they are across their portfolio, if they know what's going on, if they are across the issues, if they're dealing with them as they come up, and you know, that whether they've got a functional system of officials behind them to deliver the answers to any questions that are of public concern. And it exposes those ministers who are not doing a good job, and that's its aim. And insofar as it does that, it works, I think. Ministers who aren't across their subject areas, who aren't well briefed, and who aren't in touch with the issues of the day, you know, pretty quickly go south. Those who do know what's going on, you know, and are able to answer questions in a way that's convincing for the public, survive and do well. Now, there's a fine line there because then there's a bit of room for those who spin and so on. But eventually people get sick of seeing people giving pat answers when they know there's deeper issues. So
in writing those questions, do you ask them an easy question first, knowing that you've got something in,
of course,
in reserve?
And that's part of exposing whether they're across their portfolio area or not. The follow-up questions, one question is supplied to the minister at 11 o'clock, and it's usually a fairly detailed question, or often, or a deliberately vague one, one or the other. But the scope of that original question forms the basis for what comes after. And that question is designed to make sure the minister knows the general area, but hopefully not all of the questions you're going to ask, because you are trying to put them on their toes and see whether they really know what's going on. And so the follow-up questions can come as a surprise, and it's then incumbent upon the minister to show a general familiarity with the area and to express, if it's desirable, to do some more follow-up, or to allay the public fears and say, look, you know, this is an issue that is hot right now, but I've looked into it, and the member has a very specific question. I'd urge him to put that to me in writing if he has a particular concern, but when I looked at the issue, I found A, B, and C, and I'm convinced that this isn't the big hot issue that everyone thinks it is, for these very reasonable reasons. And a minister who's on top of their portfolio will be able to explain that in a way that makes sense to the public.
When we had you in August last year, you said you were hoping and planning on getting directly into government, and it would be an unfortunate thing if you had to spend time in opposition. In retrospect, do you think it's a good thing you're getting an apprenticeship in opposition?
From a personal perspective, it is good. You know, from a purely selfish developmental perspective, certainly in opposition as a new member, I've been given all kinds of opportunities. Of course, it's hard to see things going on in government that I think are wrong. You know, I think stepping away from the Kyoto Protocol is wrong, full stop. I think delaying entry of agriculture into the emissions trading scheme forever is wrong. I think continuation of subsidies in that area are wrong. And there's very little I can do about it apart from get up and make speeches in Parliament to that effect right now. However, in opposition, I've got a spokesperson's role for a whole portfolio. And it's government takes money from people and it distributes it. It's 33 people who get to speak about distributing it, and only one who gets to speak about taking it, and that's me. And that particular equation around how we take money in order to make sure we get the best societal outcomes is actually fairly influential. You know, that's part of what makes sure we have a fair society, that everyone pays their fair share of tax to contribute to the public good, and how that task is carried out has a big role in the future of our country. So I feel very privileged to have that opportunity to be the spokesperson on that. I'm an associate tertiary spokesperson. I get to sit on the Finance and Expenditure Committee, which is seen as the granddaddy of the committees, I guess, and gets all the controversial legislation. So I've been a part of the asset sales debate, and all of those things have been opportunities I probably wouldn't have had coming into government. And when I look at those members of Parliament who came in with Nationals, changeover, those who are new in, they're a lot fitter than I am. They spend a lot of time in the parliamentary gym, but their opportunities for career development and development as politicians able to advocate on issues, their opportunities are limited. And mine seem to be as open-ended as I can, as I want them to be, and you know, as many hours as there are in the day, I can dig into issues in my area and also more broadly and speak to colleagues about them.
If you have an idea, like recently you were on the radio, I heard, talking about Facebook and Google not paying enough tax. Not so much interested in the details of that. Just like, do you have to discuss that with colleagues before you put it out, or can you just, are you on your own to do what's right in your space?
Pretty much on my own to do what's right in my space, which is, I mean, I think one develops a bit of a radar, and if I thought it was going to cross across other people's patches or make other people feel uncomfortable, if it went against some values of the party or something like that, I would be foolish not to discuss it with colleagues. In that case, where there's clearly Facebook paying $14,500 tax in New Zealand last year and $5,000 the year before, less than your average labourer, it seems to me that something's not right there, you know, fundamentally not right. And if we want to live in a fair society, everyone has to pay their fair share. And a big multinational company oughtn't to be able to hide its revenues in another country, in another tax jurisdiction, when we have 2.2 million Facebook users in New Zealand, and there's no doubt that they've got more revenue going through here, in my view anyway. you know, we should be addressing those issues. And so the point you probably heard me making on radio is the government should be devoting resources to solving that, and particularly if bigger governments overseas are addressing this issue, New Zealand needs to get alongside them and do the same. We don't want to set ourselves apart as a country where big multinationals get an easier ride than your average citizen does. I just don't think that's fair, and I don't think that's the kind of society we want to have.
So when there is a new issue comes up or comes to your attention like that, what is the process for developing your brackets, the Labour's view on that? Is it you've got free rein within a something's not right here value statement?
Yeah, I mean, it is surprisingly straightforward. I mean, I did the research on that myself. I got the research on it myself, Anton will understand. I asked a librarian to do some research that I asked for within certain parameters an explanation of what revenue flows were going through different companies, and then looked at the results. And then I happened to see a story in the newspaper over the weekend about what Google, how other countries were addressing Google, and so I knew it was a hot topic. I just simply put out a press release that I worked through. I send a draft usually to a media person in our office who is aware of what's going on across the party. So probably if there are alarm bells at that stage, you know, there's one test which might find them, but generally that media person is answering to the spokesperson anyway. So occasionally spokespeople get it wrong and they get themselves in trouble, but I think generally the views that one has are likely to be congruent with the party. You tend to join a party that has a similar value set to your own, or else you're going to have a really difficult career. And so where there's a fairness and equity issue, putting that out into the public domain is seen as a good thing. So this story has been bigger than I expected it to be, quite honest. It seems to have taken off and developed a life of its own, but people can see that it's not fair.
If you do something like that and it does, you know, go right or particularly wrong, what's the sort of feedback like from colleagues?
Well, I have to say, as a new member of Parliament, I find that colleagues are very kind generally. And that's actually been true across Parliament, certainly in the early months. I think when you're new, people realise there's quite an induction process. There's quite a change going on. The parliamentary environment is different to any other environment I've worked in. You know, the Labour laws are not the same there. If the Prime Minister decides he's lost confidence in one of his ministers, they could be gone tomorrow, and they've
got no redress. Free written warnings.
No, that's right. There's no right of appeal or a personal grievance claim pending. That's it. You're gone. So it is a different environment, and cameras are shoved in your face at short notice. I mean, my first day in Parliament was the day, you know, first regular day of sitting was the day my holidays bill got drawn, and I had a media swarm. And I think all three of the regular TV cameras were there in my face, and about 20 microphones in a big huddle. And that's kind of intimidating.
Did you think, this is so cool?
I thought, no, I better get this right. And there's no real prep. And I think the point you're making about how many checks and balances do these things go through, when certainly for the Labour Party in opposition, we don't have a great deal of resource, and I think the public imagine that you're a well-funded machine because they see what they see, hopefully, is a professional performance on television and strong advocacy. But, of course, the Labour Party is funded by donations, so the only money we have is from the however many hundred members we have in each electorate out of their own pockets, pretty much, you know, and the parliamentarians are paid. So they're the paid staff, but there is some budget for support for research and for media. But, you know, I have access to one comms person and one researcher, and each of those people I share with about six others. So I have a third of an FTE available to me for my communications with the outside world. And that's not a lot. That's actually a fairly lean machine. And, you know, the other people who have access to those same people include the Shadow Minister of Finance and who runs across a whole lot of policy areas and the whole economics team. So it's, you know, on any given day, they're all higher up the pecking order than I am, and we're left to our own devices. And those who do well, I think, who are shown to be able to have initiative and to not mess things up too much, and, you know, and if they do mess them up for reasons that couldn't be, have been foreseen, are given more and more room to move. And if people do have trouble with the media or find it challenging or overstep the mark or make claims they can't back up or look foolish, they tend to drift from the spotlight anyway. So it's got its own self-correction mechanism. I mean, I'm learning all this mm-hmm. on the go, of course, but it's not a, certainly not a big machine in the way that the general public often think it is, and certainly not a well-funded machine. The parliamentary staff are paid generally a lot more poorly than people in government departments sitting 50 metres away, and they work longer hours, and they're asked to do a lot more. So mostly it's the people who are passionate about what they're doing and are wanting to make a difference, and that's the reason they go into that environment.
For you, is it hard work?
I would say no. I thoroughly enjoy it so far. You know, it's it is. I do feel closer to making a difference. As I say, there's frustrations with being in opposition, and a lot of frustrations with seeing things the government's doing that I think are plain wrong. That's absolutely true. But to use this example from the last 24 hours with the Facebook Google thing, a report from the Minister of Revenue on the weekend was, I'm concerned, you know, but effectively I'm not going to do anything about it right now. Today I'm told that he's said that he's asked for some urgent information from officials and he's going to look into the problem. And so, you know, there's a possible outcome there whereby government resources are right now being mobilised, as I said, you know, as was reported on the radio and on the TV last night, should happen. In order to make New Zealand societies fairer in the way it gathers its taxes. So I feel like, right, great, you know, that's actually had an impact, and there may be an outcome that is better for New Zealand as a consequence. So that feels good when that kind of stuff happens. In terms of working hard, the harder bits of the job really are in terms of family life, and MPs don't generally want to talk about that much. But it's the family who are left at home, of course, when you work sometimes 80 hours a week, who, you know, if you've got young kids or whatever, who have got to make do in your absence, and have got to put up with the fact that from one day to the next, they don't know whether you'll be in the same city as them. They can't make appointments, or if your spouse really wants to see you, the best way to do it is to make an appointment in your diary. And not many people live lives like that where a spouse has to effectively go through a secretary to get an appointment with you. It's a bit ludicrous. So that's the hard bit. You know, that is the bit that feels hard sometimes. But the job itself is incredibly stimulating, and aside from those frustrations of not being able to directly impact on things, it is rewarding.
Back to the questions of ministers and raising issues, how responsible is a minister for their department? I mean, if say, let's pretend that there was an egregious security problem in a ministry.
Hypothetically.
How far does the ministry carry the can for that?
I think ultimately the minister carries the can. And, I mean, this is battered backwards and forwards. And having worked in Treasury, you know, a government ministry, and I can see how these things work, and having spent about a little over a year in David Parker's office when Labour was in government as my first attempt to come to grips with politics, I've seen a little bit about how these things work. And the, you know, as a rule, a few mistakes from a department will be tolerated and the minister won't bear any consequences. And I think that's right, because people do make mistakes. But when mistakes are shown to be systematic, or policies are shown to be ridiculous or whatever, then the minister does bear the consequences. So I think the way in which the system works tests whether that's, you know, who's responsible. And my observation too is that often people who come to see me in my office and say, oh look, I met with the ministry and about this particular ministry about this issue or that issue, and they were, you know, they were a bit hopeless and they didn't seem to be on my side. I went and met with the minister, and the minister completely understood, and so I think it's the ministry that's holding things up. Now, I don't really buy that argument. I think that an effective minister will say to the ministry, I want you to sort out this problem, and here's why, and here's how. I think a lot of ministers hide behind the department, and it either suits them. They're either ineffective, and they can't control the ministry and what it's doing, or it's convenient for them that the ministry does their duty work, and so that they're agreeing with everybody, and the ministry's then doing what it likes in response to what the minister really wants. And so, you know, I'm always a bit hesitant about letting ministers off the hook in that regard. There are criticisms of some ministers for being too interventionist, but actually I think a minister's job is to be in touch with the department and directing its business. That's what they're elected to do, the ministers. They are there to govern on behalf of the people, not there to take a back seat and let the ministry get on with it.
So
be the front person.
Are you making a criticism of a minister's CEO mentality? Lay back, let it work.
Yeah, well, there are different kinds of CEOs. I don't know if that's the right analogy, but yeah, I am of those ministers who see themselves as salespeople, perhaps at the front of a ministry. Whereas I think they should actually be a CEO who's hands on, who's responsible for the outcomes at that ministry. Now that can be taken too far, no doubt. And also a CEO can't be held responsible for every mistake that a ministry makes. But I think ultimately the public are reasonable and they'll see patterns. And it's very hard to get political traction on an issue, in my limited experience so far, unless there's a repeat performance. If it's a one-off, it'll be in the media once, and it'll be gone. I'm trying to think of an issue where this has happened this year, and I can't off the top of my head, but there certainly are examples where somebody will make a great big noise about a problem that's happened. It plays on national radio one morning, and they might even get a 20-minute slot, you know, quite a big slot to a big audience. If you weren't listening to that particular program on that particular day, and 6 months on you strike the same problem as a citizen, as far as you're concerned, the issue's never been raised in public. Whereas something like NovaPay, for example, which is a current issue, because it keeps going wrong cycle after cycle after cycle, although people were really upset with me when it first started happening and they couldn't see anything in the media and they didn't think Labour spokespeople were saying anything about it because they hadn't heard that one show that had been on at that stage, when it gathered momentum and there were more and more incidences, the chances of them having heard one of those media incidents was greater, and then they had a feeling that their view was being represented and that they were being taken seriously because they could hear debate about it in the media and whether the government was doing its job right or overseeing it or fixing it. So I think that illustrates that the public get patterns. You know, if a problem is ongoing, then the minister gets held to account for it. If it's a one-off, then, you know, the minister's kind of grilled a bit, and if they answer in a way that's convincing, they can move on, as long as it doesn't happen again. So in the case, you know, one that I'm dealing with, there was privacy breaches at IRD. 32 in a year, which to me suggests some kind of pattern. Now, this is an interesting case because it's just kind of sitting there. It's not at the state where there's great alarm about it in the wider world. There's some nervousness because, you know, 32 is quite a lot of breaches and it affected 6,000 people, and the minister hasn't explained how it's going to be fixed or why 5,000 of them weren't contacted or whatever. But if something else happens along similar lines, that's when the thing will gain momentum. Or if the minister's not able to come up with an explanation about how he's fixed it at some point, it'll just drip along and the heat will keep on him. So that is how those issues play out, I think.
To what extent is the left of the House consciously presenting itself as an alternative government?
I think it's in everybody's mind that there's a potential alternative government there. And so ultimately we have the same goal, which is to get rid of this government, which is doing things that we disagree with. And that, you know, the way that plays out is always interesting. I've seen studies done overseas which show that opposition parties tend to attack each other furiously in the first year that they're in opposition. So I think in the States, it's in Europe somewhere. I'm not going to remember exactly where. But then as elections draw closer, opposition parties start to look much more like a firm government, because that's their job. And if they're going to win an election, they have to look like they could work together. So the political parties adapt to the election cycle in a way. And I think the inquiry into manufacturing that's going on at the moment is a real illustration of that. You've got New Zealand First and Greens supporting an inquiry that Labor's leading in the manufacturing sector. And New Zealand First and the Greens don't normally get on terribly well. I don't think they've got a famous history for not getting on. But actually, they're, you know, in Parliament now, they sit next to each other, and I can see them supporting each other from time to time. Winston Peters will get up and make a point of order in support of something Russell Norman said, and vice versa. And that is an illustration that there's an attempt to get on, and the thought that actually, if you are going to present an alternative government, you have to show that you can get on despite your differences.
Are the Greens in that space leaving the sort of the environmental end of Labour, sort of like feeling as though they haven't got the foundation because someone else is moving into that space?
It is a... I'm not sure if I understand your question.
No, it doesn't quite make sense.
Question.
does having the Greens there, though, push Labour into the centre away from that space?
Well, I think that the question really is, how do you feel about the Greens constantly saying you're flogging their policies?
Greens say, yeah. The Greens say lots of things, which some of which are true and some of which could be mistaken for being true. In that respect, lots of the policies that we have are congruent with Greens policies. There's no doubt. The other way of framing it is saying, of course, that there's lots of Labor policies that the Greens have leapt on and are now promoting as well. So there is a lot of overlap, to be fair, in the policies. Ours, you know, we do tend to be often seen as a little bit more centrist than the Greens in some areas. But to be fair, in the economic sphere, the Greens, for the last election, pitched themselves to the right of us. You know, they said they'd go into coalition with National if push came to shove. And that would have involved compromises like not putting up the minimum wage, which Labor would not be prepared to make with National. So actually the Greens went for a central space. Their slogan was a richer New Zealand or something like that, I think. And, you know, presumably that was a deliberately ambiguous phrase, but it was designed, in political terms, to capture that right vote that has an economic tinge to it, an environmental tinge to it. So
the famous blue greens.
That's right.
Which I always thought was a sort of algae, but that's just me. But yeah.
So there's, you know, on some issues, the Greens are to the right of Labor, and on some they're to the left. And there's a whole lot of overlap in the middle. And of course, in the political spectrum, everyone is trying to get their elbows out to make sure they've got enough room for their own policies. And often it comes down to who's the most effective advocate. Because certainly where there are similarities, it's about advocating for them on behalf of the public.
I was at a meeting recently looking at the national science challenges and putting together bids, I suppose, for, you know, what should be at that level. And what caused the most amount of heat was the exemplar ones that they put up, which were clearly designed to appeal to a minister. Our rich seas, accelerated development and wealth extraction from natural resources. And what that led to was a quite robust discussion about, you know, should science challenges be non-partisan and what would it take to be non-partisan. Do you think there's any chance of things like that truly being non-partisan? This, you know, a national science challenge has got to last, you know, not an election cycle or two or three, or, you know, it's got to last 10. But ultimately, a minister today has to make the decision on them.
Yep.
Do you think people really can say, no, I'm going to rise above this? This is... truly non-partisan?
I'm going to try and have my cake and eat it too here on this one. The first thing to say is that partisan is not necessarily bad. You know, the people can say politics, oh yuck, and they often do, but they'll still vote for a particular party. And I think that, you know, ultimately politicians are trying to stand on platforms that represent particular interests in society, and there's nothing wrong with that fundamentally. By the same token, you know, when you've got multi-year horizons and concerns, then the political cycle can be detrimental to the effective running of programs, and I think that's probably really the nub of your question. And there are things that can sit outside those political cycles. If a government wants to do that, it can set them up in that way. Sometimes there's a challenge in doing that. The best example is the Scandinavian one with prison populations, where there are targets set up in the parliament for prison population numbers dropping over time. And the parliamentary debates are about whether or not those targets have been met, not about being tough on crime, not about whether we should be building more prisons or this or that. But an independent body's been set up to achieve those goals in terms of reducing recidivism and introducing restorative justice programs and so on, with a target of having less criminal activity in society. And so there's a Ministry of Reducing Crime or whatever it's called, and then the minister's job is to defend the success or otherwise of achieving those targets, and no matter which side's in power, that's what the debate is. So you can frame the debate in a different way. If it's about sciences and it's and you're going for a pure science angle, you know, you could set up an independent panel to run that is very independent of government and makes decisions independently of government, and the funding sits independently of government, and then you will get much more independent outcomes, and that, you know, that depends on how the government of the day sets things up.
So how do we move this forward in terms of things like social justice in New Zealand? I mean, at the moment, you intimated this before, disparity and poverty are at levels greater than we've seen previously. We don't have the tight society that we have either, and we've got a lot more, inverted commas, consumer choice, but some of that is some of that's sustainable, some of it's not. How do we move our society to a point where we want it to be more equal and see the results of that as being positive, other than voting for you?
Yeah.
but how do you do it? As a revenue minister, how do you do it?
Yeah. Well, I do think that that public debate can be shaped by politicians in part. So do vote for me. But it is a really interesting question, and part of it is goes around how people feel about things. I think a lot of people in society at the moment feel that it's not right where we are. I had lunch with a businessman this week who is a thoroughly successful fellow who's, you know, in the business world, who's been chief executive of companies all across the world and features on some significant boards in New Zealand. And he was saying to me that he made a decision a number of years ago that he was going to drop half of his work and focus on projects that really mattered to him and to society. And he's got a whole lot of ideas that he wants to explore around how to make businesses more sustainable, how to change the culture in New Zealand so that those kind of social good aspects are rewarded, and so on. And some of those changes have to come from grassroots up, but governments can do some things around that. There are things like introducing social reporting and well-being measures into
well-being
budget planning.
Isn't the best word to use today. I'm feeling very sad.
So there are things governments can do that set things up in a way that gives the measures back to society that say we're doing well or not. And right now, for example, GDP is the most common measure of how well our society is doing. So it is a raw economic measure, and it's not a very good one. Everyone agrees it's not a very good one. My view is that it would be better to have something that, you know, a range of measures, not just GDP. Look at social progress indicators, you know, sustainability measures and so on. The Treasury has done some work around this that doesn't get us to exactly what that should look like, but is a step in that direction. And certainly if I had the resources of government at my disposal, I'd be encouraging a whole lot more work in that area to look at how we as a country can measure ourselves in different ways. And, you know, some of that will be around community and sense of well-being. Then, of course, there are the direct levers, you know, how we set up the tax system. One of Labour's big policies for the last election, and I suspect one of the ones we'll take to the next election, which is supported by the Greens as well. They'll claim this one was theirs originally, would be a capital gains tax. And, you know, in fact, most OECD countries would claim that was theirs originally. There's, I think, 31 OECD countries that have a capital gains tax and three that don't. And the OECD says it's a good idea, the Treasury says it's a good idea, and these are hardly left-wing think tanks, you know, World Bank, IMF. It's a no-brainer. We need to make sure that people pay their fair share, and right now there's a big gap in our tax system which says that those who have the resources available to them can avoid paying tax through investing in property-based investments and capturing capital gains. And so that's what a lot of people do who have got that wealth. And that means that everybody else is worse off because they're carrying a disproportionate burden of the costs of running our public services.
I've hardly started on my list of questions and we've nearly run out of time, so you're going to have to give short answers to these ones. What's the best thing that's happened this year?
Best thing that's happened this year? That's a good question. I think just the change in public mood, if that's a short answer. you know, the sense that the media are now willing to take John Key on. Up until the election last year, they gave him a pretty cruisy ride, and now they're willing to ask questions, and I'd like to see them ask a lot more questions, of course, but I don't think he can take for granted that everything he'll say will get published without question and without challenge.
What's the worst thing that's happened?
The worst thing that's happened this year? Let me think, what has government done that's annoyed me the most? They've done many things. I think, you know, if I think about my portfolio areas, I think restricting further access to tertiary education has got to be a retrograde step. You know, it's making tertiary education a privilege of the wealthy, effectively, and that's something I feel strongly is a wrong thing to have done.
What's the hardest decision you've made this year?
Hardest decision I've made this year? I think probably things around balancing time in terms of trade-offs with seeing family and the demands of the job.
What are you hoping for in the next 2 years?
In the next 2 years, I'm hoping for a surge of popularity for the Labour Party. The polls are actually been good for us since the election. If you draw a line, Wikipedia has a line, I think, that goes through all of the different polls. They go up and they go down, and, you know, in the last month or so they've been more down than up, but nevertheless, if you draw a trend line through there, you'll see that New Zealand First and the Greens have pretty much sustained their popularity from the election. The Greens had a big bump up after the election, they went down, but they're still about the same level, and we want them as a coalition partner, no doubt about it. New Zealand First have stayed the same. National Party's dropping and Labour's going up. Labour's actually got the sharpest trend of any party in the Parliament at the moment in terms of growing popularity. It's not the story you hear in the media all the time, but so over the next 2 years I want to see that trend continue. Even I'd be happy if it was a steeper rise in popularity, because I think the policies that we have are ones whose time has come. They're based on principle, and we took them to the last election and people said, ooh, that's a bit brave. But I actually think the public are coming around and seeing that they're fair policies. And I think ultimately New Zealanders are fair-minded and given time to think about policies that are about the long-term health and well-being of New Zealand. The public are coming around to those policies and also warming to the new people who are in Parliament and saying, well, yeah, actually I could imagine David Shearer as our Prime Minister. Actually, he'd be a good Prime Minister. And that all takes time for the public to warm to it. It seems to be happening, but over the next couple of years, I wish for it to happen in a tidal wave of support.
And your plans for the summer?
Over the summer, actually spending some time with my family is one of my big goals for the summer, and no doubt there'll be some portfolio work to be done through December. I think in January, the public is has the pleasure of hearing less from politicians. I think that people do engage with politics at certain times of the year, and January is not one of those times. So I'm looking, as I say, looking forward to spending some time with family.
It's the time I switch off from politics and turn on the cricket, to be perfectly frank. But yes, thank you very much. We've been speaking with David Clark on the Sustainable Lens from Radio. We've had our normal panellist Sam Mann on. I'm your host, Anton Angelo. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'm wishing everyone here a very Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to you all.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.